This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Well, we're about to kick off this, the second day of the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival here at the Destinations Fair. There are still some, although admittedly not many seats available, so do join us here on our snow-white benches. For this, our first event, Travelling Solo. Discussions about how to venture far and wide on your own. It gives me very great pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome to the stage Julia Wheeler, Hilary Bratt, Lloyd Figgins, and Phoebe Smith.
A seat. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for being here at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Thank you to our panel for being here too. We are talking about travelling solo in the next 45 minutes or so, and there'll be plenty of time for questions towards the end, so do be thinking as you're listening about the sorts of things that you want to know. How many people in the audience have travelled solo? Ooh, great. And how many people haven't yet but are seriously thinking about it? Great. We're going to persuade you by the end. Great. So, Hilary, let's begin with you, because I think it would be fair to say that you were and are a fairly reluctant solo traveller.
I'm a reluctant solo traveller. I would rather travel with a like-minded companion, but I've travelled with an unlike-minded companion, and it's not satisfactory. So, if necessary, I travel alone. And I've learned that it is actually the best way to travel, but it takes a bit of guts.
What do you love about it?
I love about it because I'm naturally, I'm quite a shy person. I mean, I've learnt to act the extrovert, but I'm the introvert. And you have to meet the local people. And anyone who's travelled alone knows that this is the key thing, that it makes you talk to locals. And this is why we travel. But if you travel in a party or with a friend, it's so easy to only talk to the friend.
In some ways, even if you are travelling with a companion or in a group, you kind of have to act as if you were solo just to get out there and experience it, don't you?
You do. You do. And it's something that good travellers are able to do, sometimes break away from the group. And I've seen it when I lead trips. I've seen it all the time, people who are able to break away, talk to the locals, but others who are shy just close in on themselves and don't quite make that push. Mm.
Phoebe, you have contributed to this book, which is the Roam Alone one that Hilary has edited, or jointly edited. And it's a lovely tale in that there are sort of unexpected consequences of you travelling alone, aren't they? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I think one of the negatives of when you travel on your own can be that actually you tend to then be paired up with other people travelling on their own. So you intend to go and experience something for yourself, but then you end up kind of experiencing it as a partnership you didn't intend on, and you can't choose that other person. It's not like when you invite a friend or a partner. And so I went, I was very lucky, I went on an Antarctic cruise ship, an expedition cruise for work as a journalist, and I got paired up with this girl, and it was 3.5 weeks sharing a room with someone. You don't know if they're going to snore. You don't know what the hygiene's going to be like. You don't know if you're going to have to fight for the bathroom. It's, you know, it's a whole kind of, oh, my goodness, I didn't even think about this. I was just, like, concentrating on the trip. And I was actually very, very lucky because the other people who were travelling by themselves, you know, I'd sort of speak to them, and some of them had nightmare stories with roommates. Some fell out. Some asked to move rooms. Some befriended other people and slept more people in a room than they should have done. But with me, it was really great. I was paired with this girl who was originally from Shanghai, but had lived for a long time in New York, and she was an accountant, but then she'd sort of gone travelling. And it was so crazy because we almost had complete mirror opposite experiences of Antarctica. So this was one of the ones that goes to South Georgia, the Falklands, and Antarctic Peninsula. And she was just mesmerised by the Britishness that existed in these places, which, of course, I was interested in, but it was about the wildlife, it was about the wilderness. And we got off at South Georgia, and there was the British Army were there doing exercises. So when we got back on the ship, all my pictures were Shackleton's graves, look at these mountains, me posing on rocks, you know, the elephant seals. Hers were all her lining up with the British Army. And then they were the stories she wanted to share with me. So we'd go out to the on the excursions, come back, and each night we'd have different stories to tell each other, because she, it was almost like she was on a different ship to me. She was having a completely different experience. So what could have been a disaster actually turned out to be a really good partnership in the end.
And she also helped you when you weren't so well.
Yeah, so I got seasick. I do get seasick. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Take the drugs. They'll offer you the drugs. Just take them. Take them. And especially if they're from the US, the drugs over there are so much better for motion sickness. They made me feel really good. And when I was first sick, you get that awful feeling where you think, I know it's going to happen. And it was the first day at sea. And, of course, there's many days at sea when you're going there. And she kind of saw me bolt out of the room and followed behind me. She held my hair. She put me in bed. She went and got the nurse. She went and got me a Coca-Cola. She went and picked up my muck boots for the land. She did everything. She said, I've put you on. You're on that Zodiac trip. Don't worry. It was like having a little nurse all of my own. And at the end, you know, we never stayed in touch, but we both said, actually, we were really lucky, because compared to everyone else, you know, it could have gone horribly wrong. Yeah. And that is a reality of solo travel. You end up being in a partnership that you actually didn't choose.
But in your day job, if I can call it that, the way that you travel most of the time, you're not just solo, you're also wilderness.
I do love the wilderness. So I, as well as travelling for work, I also write books about going into the wilderness and wild camping on my own. And more recently, last year, I went and walked something called the Arctic Circle Trail in Greenland, which is, it is because it's sort of just above the Arctic Circle. And you walk from ice cap to ocean. And you do it in between sort of, they recommend 9 to 12 days. So I thought, I've got to do it in 8. And I did it on my own. And I didn't think anything of it, because I do a lot on my own. And unlike Hillary, I'm not reluctantly on my own. I'm not antisocial, but I enjoy doing things on my own. And I think you appreciate them in different ways. But before I left, everyone in Kangerlussuaq, the place where you start this walk from, were like, you can't go on your own. You're a woman on your own. You're going on your own. And then it was only a woman in the shop just before I left. She looked me up and down. And I was with my big rucksack and everything. She goes, yeah, you look like you know what you're doing. You'll probably be all right. And I was like, that's all I needed to hear. Off I go. And just incredible experience. Met other hikers on the way, but then had those glorious moments of just... me, not the small talk. You know, when you're on your own, you don't have to have that small talk to distract you. It's just you to kind of really connect with the world and make you just feel such like a small part in a much bigger picture. And there's something quite empowering about that and confidence boosting too. Mm.
So, Lloyd, your book is The Travel Survival Guide. Who's it for?
Well, this book is really for anyone who's going travelling, whether they're on their own or whether with a group or even on a family holiday or even a business traveller. The whole idea behind the concept of the book is wherever you're going, there's certain things you need to do in order to keep yourself safe. So what I've done is I've looked at all the different aspects of travel, from which aircraft you get on, which type of vehicles you're going to be using, how to stay safe in accommodation, and put all these things together in a book, which quite literally is for anyone who's travelling anywhere, for business, even if it's a short break, but all designed to keep yourself safe and have a good time. And to break up, because we know that health and safety isn't the world's most enlightening and enthralling subject, what I've done is interspersed it with lots of different anecdotes about some of my personal adventures, some things I didn't get so right and others where I did get it right, and actually that went on to prove very, very helpful. So it's really for anyone who wants to get out there, but particularly for solo travel, where you haven't got maybe a companion that you can turn to and ask for advice. All the advice is actually in the book. So if you go through that, you'll be able to pick up just little nuggets that are going to, you know, the small things that make a really big difference when you're travelling on your own.
So one of the things that really comes out of there with, you know, beaming lights is, in terms of risk, the key to it, or reducing it, is preparation.
Yeah, it is. And preparation is key. And I actually think when I first started travelling, putting on the backpack for the first time, you know, part of the journey was the preparation. You know, flicking through the guidebooks and seeing where you're going to go is actually all part of this enormous experience that we're going on. And so, you know, some of the guidebooks have things about, you know, safety and security things. Well, I used to read all those and I used to really digest it, because I didn't want anything bad happening to me. You know, I'm a former soldier, I'm a former police officer. Things do go wrong, but I wanted to make sure that when I was going, even if I was on my own or with other people, we were going to be aware of what those dangers and annoyances were, and then put in a plan to mitigate those. So we go away, have a great adventure, come back, tell everyone about it, and then plan the next one.
Do you prefer to travel alone than with a companion or in a group?
I'm a bit like Hillary, actually. You wouldn't believe it. I'm more of the introvert. So I actually really love being on my own. And some people think I'm really weird because I do just love being on my own. And traveling on my own, I would go back to Phoebe's point, that whole feeling about being as part of the earth and part of the planet. When you're on your own, and particularly I find it at night, you know, when I was rowing across the Atlantic, I used to look up at the night sky, and the Milky Way used to be so clear, it felt as though you could just reach up and touch it. But that gave you a real sense of belonging, but it was just lovely being there on your own. So I prefer travelling on my own, but I have travelled with others
as well. I mean, that is hardcore solo travelling, isn't it?
Rowing across an ocean.
Anyone thinking of that? Don't do that as your first solo travel, I would say. So, well, we talked a little bit about, you both said that you're introverted, and I think there's something around the difference between being physically reluctant and potentially coming up against dangers, but actually having an attitude in your head and not being too shy, isn't there?
I think it's a very important point, because the reason people don't want to travel alone...
I'm not sure we can... Can we hear Hillary? No, bear with me one second.
Is it on? No.
I think it should be on. Yeah, have a go.
Is it on?
Have we got that one?
This one. Try this.
Oh.
There we go.
There we go.
So we've got Al's now. Thank you, Al.
Doesn't sound on. Is it on? No, lots of shaking heads.
Yes. It was just a question of putting the right blobble up. Okay, well done. Okay. Thank you.
Wonderful. Is this
better? Yes, that's great. So we're talking about the difference between physical and a mental angst,
yes,
I think.
And I think probably I define that quite well, in that I love... Yeah. Being on my own, like Phoebe, in wilderness, I love walking on my own, because you see the landscape, you see the stars, you see the sunsets. You're not turning to your companion and talking about the best pizza joint in London. You're looking at the sunset. But it is much more of an effort to meet people. So, you know, I think it's an important thing to recognise that if you like being on your own in the countryside, as Lloyd would say, there are risks. You know, I love walking on my own, but of course if I fall off a cliff, there's no one to say, hey, she fell off a cliff, we're going to get help. So, but, you know, it's a risk you take. So I think it's useful to separate the two.
But presumably, I mean, there's some mitigation in terms of letting people know where you're going. I mean, it sounds quite common sense, isn't it?
Yeah, and a lot of the things that you can put in place are common sense, but they're only common, actually, if you do them. So letting someone know where you're going, what time you're expecting to be back, or when you're expecting to arrive at the next town if you're going on a journey, just really basic things. So if you didn't turn up, people would know that you're not where you're supposed to be, and then they can put in the emergency procedures that you might have. So, you know, calling the local authorities to find out where you might be. So just those little things, again, that can make a big difference. And I know Phoebe, when she's off trekking off on her own in these weird and wonderful places, you know, it sounds great, and when you read it in her books, you're kind of thinking, this is amazing, I want to go off and do this. But what you don't see is all the stuff that goes behind the scenes, the preparation, and those emergency response items that are there, but, you know, they might not actually just be written about, because actually it's the boring stuff, if we're honest about it, but it does need to take place.
We all know where you are all of the time, because you're so prolific on Twitter and the other social media. So, to be honest, I feel like I know... Call me.
Well, and it's funny because you say, oh, you know, definitely a lot of preparation goes into things, but I'm slightly irresponsible. I don't always tell people where I'm going. I find it incredibly liberating sometimes to just take a risk. I mean, if we took no risks, we'd go nowhere and we'd do nothing. And I totally get about mitigating risks and, you know, letting people know where you are. But me and Hillary were talking before about travelling, and I was saying how someone told me about this app that you can now get so that your parents or your loved ones can track where you are, and you basically check in with them every single day. And I was like, okay, but that's pretty hideous, that thought, because I remember when I went and I was away for 2 years travelling and working overseas, and I think I contacted my dad twice via postcard, and I had a mobile. Obviously, mobiles are distant, but it was super expensive. Forget roaming charge. It was like you needed a mortgage to like have a mobile phone and call from abroad. So I think I just texted him after I did something very exciting, and he always said I'd much rather hit after you've done it rather than worry before you go. And of course there are things you should do, but sometimes it is incredibly liberating for me to just finish work on a Friday night. I think I just need to feel a bit of adventure and feel on my own, and no one knows where I am, and that's part of the escapism. And I think you can plan so much and you can mitigate some of your risks, but at the end of the day, sometimes you just got to go and live and just experience it and just take your chances. And as irresponsible as it sounds, it's just an incredible feeling.
Your go bag, as you call it, is fantastic. So it just means that you are ready to go at any stage. What's in it?
So I love to wild camp. I believe that not just going solo, but spending the night out somewhere by myself. I just, and obviously we don't start off like this. You know, as children, we read fairy stories where things go wrong in the dark, in the night. You know, we're walking in the woods and there's someone out to get you, be it a beast or a axe murderer or something. We've all watched the horror films. And the first time I did my solo camp, you know, I was terrified. I heard a twig snap and I was convinced someone was coming to get me. And, of course, it was just a rabbit, because it's always a rabbit, because there aren't people hanging around out in the mountains ready in case there's a single woman walking around on her own. So I just got addicted to doing this on my own. Each trip, I got more confident, more empowered, and I just wanted that feeling again. And so I could do that and fit that in with a busy full-time job. I thought, well, I've got to have a bag ready. So, like you said, I call it my go bag, and I have everything I need for what I call a wild night out, my kind of wild night out. I'm awful in a city, in a nightclub, but, you know, put me in the middle of the mountains in the fog, and I'm in my element. And yeah, it's just packed ready with a tent or a bivy bag, with a sleeping bag, an inflatable pillow, because, you know, I always say enjoy, not endure, as one of my mottos. And then, yeah, waterproofs, it is Britain, camping stove, and loads of chocolate. I love chocolate. So, you know, what's the point in going out doing these things if we can't eat chocolate? So lots of chocolate and anything that's a treat, you know. And I, you know, cook myself warm food, and I, you know, make myself warm drinks, sometimes with a sneaky bit of whiskey in. And, yeah, it's just incredible. Like you said, watching the stars. And if you have that bag ready, it just removes that barrier psychologically, yeah. I think, to say, oh, where did I put this, where did I put that? I just have it ready, and it's either by the front door or in the boot of my car, and then when I get that urge, I can just go and there's nothing stopping me.
You talk about people being... Sorry, Hilary, you're going to say something. Go.
Chip in with something that is working.
Yeah.
Yes. Keep going. No. Yep.
Can you hear?
Oh, so I think it's working now, Hilary.
There you go.
It's working now.
Hold it very close.
If I talk past my bosom, it's
probably... Keep it very close. There we go, we're in.
Sorry, I just wanted to chip in something about safety that Phoebe said, and it's a good point, is that the more remote you are, the more safe you are in the developing world, because thieves and so on aren't going to hang out in the wilderness, they're going to hang out in the city. So if you're worried about safety, you're actually much safer in a wild place than you are in a city. And Lloyd looks as though he might have a comment.
No, I think so long as you... Again, it comes back to that preparation. So, I mean, I work with organisations and individuals who are going to some of the most remote parts of the world, and we put in place, you know, their risk management strategies for that. So we had one client not so long ago, and we were looking at their emergency evacuation plans, and they were going to be working in a place called Gough Island. Now, Gough Island is one of the most remote places on the planet. So I said to them... and the topography there is really quite difficult. High risk of lower leg injuries. And I said, if you had someone who had a lower leg fracture, what are we looking at with regards evacuation time? And this guy looked at me and he paused and he said, if all the stars aligned and there was a ship in the area and they were prepared to divert and they could get into our little port, from the time that they could get to us, or from the time of injury to the time that we could get them to a primary medical facility, if all those stars aligned, 6 weeks. So that gives you an indication as to making sure how you do that preparation. So it meant that we had to send them off into the Brecon Beacons with one of our ex-SAS chaps who taught them how to survive in the wilderness if you are injured. We put them through extensive medical training so that they could self-treat, and then taught them all about evacuation. So if you're in a remote area, there's loads of little gadgets you can have out there which rely on satellite, where you can actually hit the SOS button. It comes straight down on your location, and it even has text capability, so you can actually describe what type of emergency it is. So you could say kidnap, it could be medical incident and so on, but it does mean that then all the rescue services can spring into action. And you're absolutely right. The more remote you are, the fewer bad people there are. And, you know, when we first arrive in a country, whether we're solo or not, that's when we're at our most vulnerable, because we don't have a baseline of what is normal in that particular area. So, I mean, just ask the audience, just raise your hand if you've ever been to Rome. Quite a few of you have been to Rome. So when you first went to Rome, what did you think of the driving? Pretty hairy, right? But after you've been in Rome 2 days, you realise that that's normal for Rome. But it's not what we expect perhaps in the UK. So when we look at safety and security, we need to get that baseline of what is normal in order that we can then spot abnormalities to that. So if you're in a remote part of the world, you realise that what is normal is the villagers going about their normal thing. Someone suddenly appearing with, you know, that might do you harm is going to look very abnormal in that situation. So it allows us then the opportunity to put in place measures to avoid that harm. And so you're absolutely right. It's usually when we arrive and in the crowded places that we're a lot more vulnerable.
It's funny, I just want to jump in there, because when you said about, oh, you know, and if you break your leg and do that, well, then my mentality is, well, I just won't break my leg then. And I know that sounds really ridiculous, but when I was going off on this Greenland trek, suddenly they were like, you don't have a sat phone, you don't have this, how do you call help? And I said, well, I'll just have to get myself out of it. And it does change the way. Just having that knowledge, it changes the way you act. Like, you know, when you're walking, you just think, that looks a bit, you know, that step looks, it might be a bit precarious. I'll test it before I step on it. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, you can do all this planning and all that, but also I just think you're different when you're on your own anyway, because you naturally think, yeah, it's on me. And we've become as a society a little bit of a blame culture, and a little bit will fall over, whose fault is it? And to me, it's all about taking responsibility for yourself. That's why I love doing things on my own. I love, you know, yes, you get the benefits of being your own, but you also then, you have to take the risks and responsibility for yourself on your own too. But that's incredible. That's an amazing feeling, and it makes you think about the world a lot more and your place in it and what you're doing and the strain you'd put on people if you needed help. And when I go walking in these remote places on my own, I always take walking poles, and I take them, one, because they help when you're walking with a backpack, but I also in my head think, and I've had no proper training like Lloyd here, but I think, oh, if I broke something, I would use that walking pole to, like, get myself out. And I'm stubborn. I'm really stubborn. And I just think there would be a way I would do it. And I think I'm like Hillary as well. We both said, we're just eternal optimists. We always assume it will all work out all right. It normally does.
Hillary, how much do you trust your gut when you're out there alone or not alone?
How much do I trust my gut?
Are you aware that you get feelings and you act on them, or do you press on regardless?
I press on regardless. I have to. You have to. One has to. And I think, I mean, sort of impinging on this was one of the longest solo trip I did was a 1,000-mile ride in Ireland on a horse, on 2 ponies. And the worst possible thing happened with my beloved Connemara Molly, who I had bought and was my dream pony. She was killed. She fell off a cliff. And I was aware that, you know, I'd been in charge of this animal for couple of months at that point. And I hadn't fulfilled my duty. You know, the animal had died. And the shock to my self-confidence was huge. But I knew if I didn't then find another pony and continue the ride, I'd never get over it. And so I did. I had a break. I came back to Ireland. I hired Peggy, who was absolutely wonderful, and ended up with this very positive feeling. And so that was a gut instinct. You know, it wasn't really gut instinct. It was just, this is a lifelong dream, and I can't sever it because it had a nightmare halfway through.
And it's almost a case of, that's the great thing about being on your own, I think, and making those decisions. You have to, the things that go wrong are the things that then start to define you. There's that saying, isn't there, that it's not the things that happen to you, it's the way you handle them when they do. It's not about falling down, it's getting back up again. And it's exactly that. And I think solo travel does that to you. It forces you to have to make that decision and deal with it.
There's no one else to blame. You have to be really resourceful. And if it doesn't go right, it could be outside circumstances, but it could be your fault.
Yes.
So you make
you
sure it does go
that.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
And how does that how is that translated when you get back in terms of the way your attitude to everyday life? Do you gain a confidence from it?
I think travelling alone, because I had to, and my first trip properly alone was 4 months in South America when I was in my 20s, and it utterly changed me as a person. And I think in the Rome Alone book, and the subtitle is Tales from Reluctant Solo Travellers, that's the message that comes through. And actually, of the audience, I think there was only one hand who was still planning to solo travel. And it does change your life. There are 40 stories in this book of life-changing experiences of people who didn't want to. And it utterly changed me. I learned that I could do it. I could cope with people. I could cope with eating alone in restaurants. I could be master of my fate and enjoy the fate that I was master of.
So, Lloyd, have you ever been in a situation, perhaps alone, where you've thought, I don't know if I'm going to get out of this?
Well, I definitely felt alone. I was on an aircraft. I used to do a lot of work in South America, and I was based in Lima. And I'd been asked by an expedition company to go to Colombia, and this was during the 90s. So the civil war was still raging in Colombia, but parts of the country were starting to open up. So you get a lot of expedition companies wanting to be the first ones in there to get their customers something new. So they send people like me in first to do a recce and to make sure it's safe. And I was on this flight into Bogota, and then we hit some turbulence. And hit turbulence quite a few times. But then this turbulence started getting a lot worse. And then it got really bad, where you could see the wingtips, if you looked out the window, that one minute you were kind of looking down at the ground, the next minute the wing was right up in the air, and it just felt as though there was a giant hand throwing this aircraft around the sky. And then I looked at the cabin crew, and they were strapped into their seats. And, you know, these were Colombians. They usually have this lovely olive skin, which was now really white, so that was a bad sign. And then lots of screaming, shouting and vomiting, all those sorts of things going on. And then it went absolutely silent. And the woman in front of me had long hair, and her hair was just out like a fan, like this. And in the old days, the back of the aircraft where I was the smoking area, and the ashtrays in the seat arms had popped out and were floating next to me at eye level. There was a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey, not mine, floating in the aisle, and I realised we were falling, and that aircraft was quite literally falling out of the sky, and there was zero gravity in the cabin. And at that point, I thought, I'm not getting out of this. This is the end. But then, luckily, the aircraft re-equalised, and then there was a lot more turbulence, and we eventually got it onto the ground, or the pilot got it onto the ground. And I was the last person off that aircraft. And as I walked past, the pilot was stood in the doorway, looking quite proud of himself, although very, very sweaty. I said to him, how far did we drop? And he just went, 200 metres. So for 200 metres, it was just absolutely free-falling through the air. And I really thought that was the end. But again, even if you think about that, if you think about where you're sat on an aircraft, it makes a massive difference to survivability rates. So Popular Mechanics magazine did some research on every single air crash in the US since 1971, and they found that your rates of survival depend on where you are in the aircraft. So if you're sat at the front, business class, first class, your rates of survival are below 50%. 49%. Over the wings, in front of the wings, is about 56%. But bear in mind, those wings are full of aviation fuel. The rear of the aircraft, your survival rates go up to 69%. And you can increase that even further by sitting no more than five rows away from an emergency exit and having an aisle seat. An aisle is going to get you out of that aircraft much quicker than a window seat is. So again, those little things make a huge difference. And when I was on that aircraft, I really did think it was the end. But this stupid thing went through my head and was saying, it's all right, you're at the rear of the aircraft, you're at the rear of the aircraft.
Actually, you were hanging on to that.
Exactly, hanging on to any hope I actually had. But, you know, look, if you're sat in business or first, at least if the aircraft does go down, you'll be
comfortable. You'll go down happy. So. You'll all have been drinking the wine. You'll be in your lifelike bed. You'll be like, if this is the end, at least I'm ending it this way. Definitely.
I think it's possibly traditional wisdom that a single woman travelling alone is potentially in more danger than a single man. Is that something you subscribe to?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm one of these people who I don't... It sounds really weird. I don't really think of myself as a woman. And it's not that I think of myself as a man either. I just don't think of my gender at all. I just am what I am, and I love doing what I do. But I met a lot. It's other people's perception. They always go, but you're a woman travelling on your own, or you're a woman going off into the wild on your own, a woman doing this work on your own. And I'm like, so what? I actually find that, especially with travel, I think you get, as a woman on your own, you actually get looked after more. And you tend to get the opposite effect, I find. People try and take you under their wing almost too much, and you're like, leave me on my own. I'm happy to navigate this marketplace by myself, or, you know, I really want to explore this. So, yeah, I actually think it is the opposite. You know, you're a lot less likely to get into a fight or this kind of thing. And I think, Hilary, you've found the same, haven't you?
Yes, I found just the same. And actually, one of the most useful things I read about it was ages ago, probably about 40 years ago, by Dervla Murphy, who's the most wonderful, always solo traveller, sometimes with her daughter. And she said the trick of it, and she's thoroughly intrepid, but she said there's such a phobia amongst women that they're vulnerable, and she said, and that they're frightened of men. And she said, turn it to your advantage. If you feel you're being followed by a hostile man or a group of men, turn round and say, I wonder if you guys can help me. I'm looking for such and such. And she said, it really works. And it does. You know, it's such an interesting trick, because most men do want to be a decent man. If we look frightened and, you know, walk faster, we become prey. If we look confident, and I think this is absolutely essential, you know, shoulders back, head up. And, you know, if push comes to shove, ask for help. And it does work. So, you know, I've learned to use the feminine trick of sort of, please, you know, I'm a weak, helpless woman, can you help? And, you know, I'm strong and tough, and I can be strong and tough. So we do much better than men. Men have all the disadvantages. there could be an answer here.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Are you in touch with your feminine side, Lloyd?
I'm very much so. I haven't been in fights either.
But do you travel in a tutu?
I could do. Something I'd be open to. But actually, statistically, men are more likely to get into trouble because they engage in more risk-type behaviours than women generally do. And you're absolutely right about walking with purpose. When you first arrive in a place or when you're out there, nothing says I'm new and don't belong here than a tourist with a map. And again, that comes down to doing your preparation and making sure you know where you're going, how you're going to get there. Walk with purpose. When we teach travel safety and security courses, and even hostile environment courses, we train people to walk with purpose, to walk with authority, that you know where you're going.
Okay, stand up here and do us a walk with authority, please.
Straight your stuff, Lloyd.
Well, I'll tell you what I will do is demonstrate to you how not to go around, first of all. And that's how most people go around nowadays, which is like this, where they're just looking at their mobile phone. I've lost my peripheral vision. I really don't know what's going on around me. And what's even worse is then when you go and stick some headphones in, so you've then lost your partial sight of sense of sight, you've entirely lost your sense of hearing, so you're now relying for your personal safety on taste, touch, and smell. So they're not very effective when we're looking at pre-event indicators. Your sight and your hearing are the things that are going to alert you to something actually going wrong. So walking around like this is not helpful.
Not going to do it.
If you want to walk around, I'll come out from behind the scene.
Okay.
If I'm going
surprise
from
us.
HB.
Mind boggles.
Focusing directly on where I'm going and walking straight to that place.
Off the stage.
Off the stage.
Yeah. But look where you're going.
I'm also using my peripheral vision. So I'm actually, although I'm looking over there, I can see everything that's going on around me because my head is up and I'm shoulders back, as you said, in walking with purpose. And it makes a huge difference. Yeah. But the other thing I would say is, on Hillary's point, if you think you're being surveilled or someone is following you, don't think that there's anything wrong in looking at that person and making eye contact with that person. It has been proved by psychologists that it has a real deterrent effect. So if you feel as though you're being followed by somebody, actually turn around and look at them. And, you know, it is something that is, you know, that can be done. And also think about the side of the street that you're walking on as well. So, you know, we hear about these motorcycle robberies, particularly in London, where they come up behind you, rob you of your mobile phone or your handbag or something. Well, actually, if you're facing oncoming traffic, that makes it a lot harder for them to do that. Mm. So it's all about, the small things that make a big difference. And that's, you know, when I wrote the book, I wanted to put all those things in there in order that, you know, you could pick up on those little nuggets in order to keep yourself safe in whatever environment you're in. Mm.
Okay. Let's open the floor to questions. Who's got a question? We'll come get the microphone to you here.
See, that's running with purpose. Did you see that?
Have we got the microphone, the Al's mic, please?
Hello. Oh.
Yes.
My question really is about loneliness when you're travelling on your own and sense of purpose. So I've done a lot of travelling on my own, and yet another beautiful view, yet another fabulous church or temple. But sort of when you're on your own, kind of what's the point? It's all a bit lonely. So how does one address that?
I think you're looking at Hillary to answer first, and then we'll come to you, Phoebe, for your ideas.
It's a good question, and I don't think there's a simple answer. It is the downside of travelling alone. Abroad, most lone travellers do meet up with other English-speaking travellers, and you feel it's a bit of a no-no. You know, you're supposed to be there to enjoy the local people, local culture. But you actually get desperate just to talk English, you know, to speak English. So when I'm on my own, I do in the evening look out for other English-speaking people. Keeping a journal is, you know, you're communicating in writing, but there's the feeling of sharing something. These days, I'm sure, you know, people are on social media all the time. I'm not, because it's not what I do. One of the other things, and this is, it's not quite the loneliness thing, but in terms of meeting people, meeting the locals, when I travelled a long time in South America, I liked sketching, and I had a sketchbook, and I drew the portraits of the local children, and they absolutely loved it, and it was so much more effective than a camera, because a camera is a distancing thing. But if you're drawing, it's something, there's nothing mysterious about it. They weren't very good drawings, but then I would give it to the children, and you know, that any feeling of loneliness dissipated, because I had something to do and I was engaging with the locals.
Lovely thing to do. Phoebe.
I always try and give myself a purpose. I mean, it sounds really funny, but so when I was on that Antarctica trip and we got to the Falkland Islands, even though there were lots of other solo travellers on the trip, a lot of them got that kind of group mentality that people do get when they travel, and they suddenly, like, we've all got to stay as a pack. And it's particularly notable on one of those things because you're all wearing the same jacket that they've given you, so it's just like a yellow pack of penguins. So first thing I did was escape the pack. I went straight to the pub. Struck up a conversation at the bar with the barman. Locals come in talking to them, and I just started asking questions, trying to find out stories. I heard that there was a shipwreck, so I hitchhiked my way down to go and see the shipwreck, because there was no buses, there's no way I could have walked there in time. And then I hitched a lift back again. Someone invited me in their house for tea, and I just gave myself this mission of, I'm going to find some stories. And the thing you mentioned about social media has really opened that up. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you, of course you'll get lonely. Everyone gets lonely at some point. But actually, I've seen a lot of couples out at meals and they're definitely lonely too. So people do get lonely. But social media, I find, is great. People are very critical of it. But I find, for me, trying to encourage people to get outside more and get into the outdoors, by showing people these amazing places and sharing it with them, it makes people want to do it too. And it also empowers people to think, well, if she can do it, I can do that too. So I see it almost as that's then my purpose, is I'm here on my own. And if I'm lonely, sometimes I'll post maybe an Instagram story or a short video, just actually admitting it and being honest on social media and saying, I'm here, this is beautiful, I'm feeling a bit this way. And you can't believe the response you get now. People are very engaged with each other. And I recently, over Christmas, I gave up my Christmas to Sleep the Three Peaks for Centrepoint, the homeless charity. And it was miserable weather on most of the days. Of course, it was winter. And the middle day, I was on Scafell Pike, the highest mountain in England, sleeping on there. My tent collapsed. It was gale force winds. It was raining. I was really upset. And I just posted a video, very honestly, like, I'm so tired. I'm hungry. I'm sick of asking people to donate. But I suppose this is what a homeless charity... And then straight away, people were sending me messages of support, telling me to keep going. And it just boosts you. And I just think in this day and age, you never really are alone. And that's what travel's all about.
Good advice. Good advice. Thank you. Other questions? Oh, we'll go handy there, and then we'll come to you.
This is a rather specific version of the previous question, really. When I travel on my own, I'm completely happy all day long, but I want really creative ideas for how to find people to have dinner with in the evening, because sitting reading my book evening after evening gets tedious.
So I have a friend who, and don't judge this, she uses Tinder to do this. Not to sleep with people, she does not sleep with them. It's Tinder for friendship and to go meet with people. And she swears by it, honestly. And people are using it more and more now as a kind of, let's meet and have something to eat. Don't judge it, it works for her.
There's an organisation, specifically this is for female solo travellers, called Maiden Voyage. And Maiden Voyage actually have ambassadors in lots of the major cities around the world. And actually, you can then, once you've joined Maiden Voyage, I think it's free to join, they'll put you in touch with their different ambassadors around the world. And the whole idea is that you can meet with that person, you can have supper with them, and then they will also give you information about things you can go, do, and see, and then connect you with other people within their network. So that might be something you want to look at.
Okay, there's another question just here. And have we got anybody over here who's got a question? I don't want to... No. Okay, go ahead.
I guess this is for Floyd and also the women, in case they have any tips.
I'm
looking
close.
For tips for staying safe on long train rides overnight in sketchy places.
You're looking for tips?
Tips.
Okay.
Suggestions.
When you say sketchy places, you're...
High crime locations.
Swindon.
Countries.
Okay, obviously with train journeys, statistically the safest place to sit in a train, and this is for accidents, is in the carriage behind the middle carriage in a backward-facing seat. So statistically that's the safest place to sit.
Write it down.
But if you're thinking about your personal safety, again, some of the things that Hillary's actually said would go for exactly if you're in a train carriage. If you're in a carriage and there's a lot of noisy people, might be drunk, you know, football hooligans, clearly just put time and distance between yourself and what might cause you harm. Keep your luggage really, really close to you. And I know in some parts of the world that people, particularly on sleeper carriages, have been invited to have a drink with people. Their drinks have been spiked. They then go unconscious and they wake up and all their luggage and all their belongings is gone. So it's a case of making sure that you can... Actually, what I tend to do is padlock my belongings to something like the bed frame. So they can't actually... Even if I'm unconscious, they still can't take my bag anywhere. They might be able to empty it, but they can't really take it. So wire meshes around it, things like that to keep it safe. But also,
you won't need that in Swindon, though, will you?
Oh, no, you'd be surprised.
Especially in Swindon. Only in Swindon.
There's loads of different gadgets out there that you can use for keeping stuff safe. But keeping your personal space is really, really important, and making sure that people don't enter into that, you know. But guards on trains. think where is the cord to pull in case you need to get hold of the guard. And so whenever I enter a train carriage, I'm looking for where that hammer is, I'm looking for where the pull is, I'm looking for that safest seat. So in any environment, I'm doing this all the time. People think I'm a real spotter when it comes to these things. But actually, it satisfies me, and it means that I know that if something does happen, I talk about what-if scenarios. So what if this happened, what if that happened? And I do that all the way through a journey, whether it's on a train or anywhere else. And I'm always thinking about those what-ifs and then put it in measures to mitigate those what-ifs.
Don't underestimate other travellers as well on the train with you. I always kind of look around and see if there's any people like me or if any other women. And you just kind of nod to each other and you know. And I mean, even on the trains in this country, you know, I'll be travelling out with my laptop and stuff and I'll just be like, do you mind just watching my stuff while I go to the toilet or while I go to the buffet car? And people, and that's what I would like to say, people are generally and genuinely nice. Most people are, and they're not out to get you. And I've travelled on the Trans-Siberian across from China all the way to Moscow, and all I experienced was warmth and friendliness, even in the most sketchiest of places. People trying to share food with me, people wanting to, even if we couldn't speak the same language. So I think, yes, definitely do what you said, but be open for actually some of the sketchiest areas can be the most wonderful people.
I think that's absolutely the message. Most people are nice.
Yes.
Particularly in the developing world. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Have we convinced you that you ought to go... Yeah. Can we get a microphone there? Sorry to put you on the spot. Have we convinced you that you might have a go?
Well, I know I will have a go because in the 70s I did.
Yay.
But a lot of has happened since the 1970s.
Well, we wish you good luck, and all those people who've done it before, go out there and do it again. Phoebe, Lloyd and Hilary are going to be over at the Stanford's stand signing their books. Go and have a look at those. There's a huge variety. They're all very different books, but they're absolutely packed full of inspiration and ideas. We are obviously going to walk in a very direct way. We're going to follow Lloyd off the stage.
Purposely,
with all peripheral vision.
Can I just say that the only place on the planet that you can currently get my book is here. It's not actually released until the 5th of April, so if you want a copy and you want it signed, today is definitely the time to get it, otherwise you'll wait until the 5th of April.
That is what I call purposeful. Lead us off the stage, Lloyd. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks to the panel.
Thank you.